cost and only create more problems.
Okay, anything else to be said on this at this point?
Can we, would it be possible for us to go through these sections, then recess for a while, and then come back to them before we make motions on specific sections?
Well, David, I think the question is well taken. I don't expect, now, I mean, if somebody did make a motion, I don't expect you to be held to that position from now till the end of time, because I think this is a kind of an integrated package. And what we're doing, if somebody wants to make a motion, fine, and we'll consider it in concept, and people can feel free to reconsider. We won't go through any formalities on that either. If you want to reconsider, you just bring it up, and we'll do it.
So,
and so, yes, John.
If section four were removed from D engrossed, do you have that much problem with 4A?
Well, I've got less of a problem with 4A. My main objection is that we have such a body of case law build up that I'm not sure I'm ready to go to the minority rule in this country by statute, but I don't feel nearly as strong about that as I do about some other things in here. And I would welcome some explanation again as to why that version, what is the issue that you'd be interested in resolving with this new language?
Is there 4A?
Pardon?
In which 4A? 4?
In 4A, what is the kind of situation that concerns you on that? Do you think that it's too loose the way it is now?
Well, I've been reading that case that was presented to some of us.
Yeah, Stroud case.
Stroud.
Yeah.
Case, and it was reviewing that, I think, and the fact this takes us back prior to that ruling, that case law. It seemed fair to me.
Okay. Now, let me ask counsel this question. Do you think that prior to the Stroud decision that there was any substantial difference between Section 4A and the Oregon case law?
It's hard for me to tell. The court said that it thought that the majority position was the better position, but there is no language in there specifically overruling earlier cases. I don't know whether there are any earlier cases that just went down the line and adopted the restatement that is now in Section 4A. But fairly clear that Oregon law prior to 75 was closer to 4A than it is now.
Okay, what about the, I can't remember the name of the case, but it was an automobile salesman, and it was a fraud situation, and as I recall, the dealer or the owner or the corporation for which the frauding salesman worked was held responsible for punitive damages because of the fraud committed by the salesman. I'm wondering if was that mentioned in the Stroud opinion? Anybody remember?
It was not.
Okay, because
there are a couple of automobile dealer cases. One is involved Mike Salt Pontiac, and that did not involve a salesman. The other one is I want to say Worldwide Auto Distributors, which involved the sale of a new Dodge, if I remember correctly, which occurred about the same time, but the cases don't cite each other.
Well,
they come essentially to the same conclusion.
I can understand why the Stroud opinion, in and of itself, might cause some concern. I suppose that might be an understatement, because I do think the case went fairly far. I am concerned that this is more than just a response to that one factual situation, and I'm thinking about the situation where the corporate employee, who's not authorized to defraud, nonetheless does it, whether it's in the sale of real estate or in the sale of a car or other things. I wouldn't want I mean, I think it's good public policy that corporate employers respond in punitive damages if their employees are acting fraudulently. I'm less concerned about saying that employers shouldn't be responsible if their employee beats somebody up. If their employee, in order to further the business of the employer, defrauds the customer, then I would not want to see the employer insulated from the claim for punitive damages. Do you see that distinction, John, I'm trying to make there? I'm not too sure that I wouldn't agree with you that we might address the narrow factual situation in the Stroud case. If we can do that without undermining what my concern is, then I would be receptive to that. Counsel, did you have any comment on that?
Excuse me, Farrell. They said they need me down on the floor for a quorum.
They need
short
you
one. I wanted me. Did you send the note? Shall I go? I better go on down there a minute. So I think they're waiting to get started.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, they need you. There's nobody there.
Nobody's around, buddy.
You're in the governor's office.
You're the junior member of the Senate at the table, so we have to go down. Well, we won't do very much when you're gone, Ronnie.
Sorry.
In fact, we'll skip over, I think. I didn't hear that crack.
You're the only one I can get.
The council said it again.
Yeah, I think the Stroud case referred to whether the employee was a managerial employee or whether he was, I believe, a menial employee,
yes.
And that's what the case itself was on
that's,
point
that's
about,
right.
Whereas some of these others talk about ratification and approval of the act.
Okay.
I think it's fair to say that in Oregon, prior to the Stroud case, the court made a distinction between a managerial and a menial employee. I mean, that was the name of the categories. And the essential holding in the Stroud case was that an agent is an agent. Corporations can only act through people, and that every employee is an agent of the corporation. They may have different areas of responsibility, but within those areas of responsibility, an agent is an agent. And that was I hope I don't sound like I'm arguing one side or the other, but that was the substance of the Stroud holding, and Section 4A takes a different view of that and says some agents are more important than others and need to be involved.
Yes, Dick.
I don't know how much litigation there's been on this subject since Stroud. My sense is if we do make this change, we're going to be inviting a whole lot more litigation in our appellate courts just to try to reinterpret this change, particularly in terms of there's a lot of language there that any litigator is going to pick up on right away in terms of trying to present or create evidence that's going to get to the jury, be it in terms of the definition of a managing agent, whether or not the employer authorized the doing in the manner, whether or not the employee was unfit, whether or not the employee was, quote, acting in the scope of employment. My sense is whenever we make a change in the case law or the law that exists, aside from the policy side of it, and I don't agree with the policy, I don't think the case has been made that we have to enact 4A as part of this package to somehow solve the tort or insurance crisis in Oregon, and that's particularly based on some of the information that came to the House Committee as a result of our review of every products liability case filed in the past 8 years, I believe. I just think we're inviting more litigation if we do something like this.
Okay. I just now picked up a note here that I don't know when it was put beside me. It said, we need you and Senator Brenneman on the floor for a quorum. Spelled with a C.
It was put there at the same time that she delivered her note to Senator Brenneman.
Well, I'm wondering if I should, they really do want me down there.
Mr. Chair?
I think so.
Yes.
I would move that we recess till 3 o'clock to give you a chance to go down. If we can't reconvene at that time, you'll let us know.
All right. Well, if it's just a quorum call, I could be back up in a couple of minutes. The Senator Cohn's away, and so I think we will. Let's recess for 10 minutes. 10 minute recess. Try to resume here 10 minutes to three. The conference committee will come back to order. Maybe we've momentarily exhausted punitive damages. Is there let's try something else. Okay, let's take a look at joint and several liability, pages 4 and 5. For a minute.
Those are the old page numbers. For those of you who are in the new page numbers, it's yes. Pages 8 and 9.
All right. Well, wait a minute now. Here, we got a couple things we can do.
You want to go back and...
Let's go back and pick up... go back on page 4 for a minute. Yeah. Do we have agreement on...
Thank you.
There's no difference on section 2 and 3 between the committee reports. Do we have agreement on that? Any objection to that?
Does the... just a clarification for the record. I think there's... For a layperson, would this section preclude a physician who was operating under the influence of alcohol and amputated the wrong leg or perhaps took out the wrong kidney during a surgical operation? Would the way the section's written now, would that preclude punitive damages?
No, it wouldn't preclude punitive damages. The key words are on line 15. Well, the key phrase here on in answer to that question is subsection 2. The practitioner must first be acting within the scope of the practice for which the license was issued, but I think very key words are the words without malice. That means malice in fact or malice in law. In other words, malice as that term is used in determining when punitive damages would lie. So in your example, David, the current law allows recovery of punitive damages in that kind of a situation, and there's no change in that under this section.
Okay, just for the record, without malice would cover that particular incident that I described.
Yes, okay. It would. And I would also, for example, a therapist would not be immune from a claim for punitive damages if the therapist became sexually involved with a patient, because number one, the action is outside the scope of the license, and two, there would be legal malice because of the conduct, that type of conduct, because I think we can agree that it's conduct that would be contrary to societal interests. It would rise to the level where punitive damages would be proper. Maybe there's some other examples some people would like to inquire about. Dick?
Well, I don't pretend to be a student of this particular section. I'm a little troubled that we're treating folks in the healthcare area differently from any other professional or business person. But aside from that, I guess I'm not quite as comfortable as the chair in terms of the response to Representative Dick's question. I don't know that without malice is going to allow an individual to proceed if, in fact, a person has acted recklessly, which I think would be how a case would be pled in terms of any kind of culpable or mental state if a person did happen to be under the influence. It seems to me to have malice, you have to be able to form some kind of intent or you have to have some specific goal. Although I certainly could be better educated on that, just what we mean, but if a person was under the influence of either alcoholic beverages or some other controlled substance, and unfortunately, I think as we've heard from Mr. Ewelling from the Board of Medical Examiner, there are scores of physicians in the state who are operating under a limited practice already, and the literature I've seen suggests that in all professions, you could have as high as 10% of those professionals, among them healthcare practitioners, who may be operating under the definition of being impaired. And unfortunately, it's a significant number of those folks are impaired because of controlled substances or possibly alcoholic beverages. And I'm not as confident, Mr. Chair. I apologize with the statement or the definition or our intent that if a person acted in that condition or were to cause an injury, whether or not they would be liable given the definition here. I don't know if we can ask on a short basis for some quick research on that issue, but it would make me feel more comfortable in terms of giving Representative Dix a kind of answer that we could all agree to.
All right. We can, I think, do we have West Digest in this building or not?
Yes.
Okay, well.
About 15 feet behind you, through a couple of walls.
All right, well.
So that if you want to take a recess at some point, we could.
We can certainly look into that, but I am. Senator Cohn was the principal author of this section.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
It arrived at the fact because we had so much testimony of doctors who say, well, every time we have to go in and we defend ourselves against punitive damages and it went on and on and on and on, and that this was. This seemed to be just one area where you could, that without changing, you could really make a statement that, you know, and again, it's a question, it's not a question I agree with Representative Dix about selecting people out, but it seemed that half of the thing we're doing with this whole tort reform is trying to resolve a particular crisis with the physicians, and half of what they came to us and fussed about was that somehow or another there were cases always continually brought against them, having to defend themselves against punitive damages when, in fact, they never turned out to be the case, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this was just, you know, and I'm not here to say that this going to saw that this is probably good law, because I'm not sure that there are a lot of things in here that I think is really pretty poor law. But I suppose this is the less onerous of a lot of the things that we have included in here, and that's just my position on it, and that's just what I
would concur. My concern, I think Representative Springer raised the question. I mean, I understand what we're trying to get at. My concern is, I don't know an amputation or someone's taken out the wrong kidney, but the full committee heard testimony that there was a case in Oregon City where a physician operated in the emergency room using the wrong end of a scalpel under the influence of alcohol and severing several arteries in a gentleman's leg. And I'm concerned that because that physician operating under the influence of alcohol, I understand they don't want punitives included where there isn't a clear case of recklessness, but where a physician is operated under the influence of alcohol and clearly using the wrong end of a scalpel would indicate that particular physician in that particular case was should be, I would think in that instance, punitive should be at least asked for. And that's my concern. I understand the physicians who always get nailed for punitives in requesting in the initial request or the initial filing, but on the other side, I was wondering if we could find some language that would make sure that where there's been recklessness, that punitives can at least be filed for. And Senator DeVry has indicated that without malice covers that, and I guess Representative Springer indicates that he is not so confident in that.
So that's where I'm at. I do understand, Senator Cohen, what you're trying to accomplish.
I'm looking for language, too. It may not be a way to improve it, but if there is, let's look for it.
Well, all I could add, we discussed it in committee. It was a suggestion both of our counsel and Kathleen Buffet that the word malice would deal with it, because we had in fact talked about changing it, and then our counsel came back to me later and said, whoops, you don't want to do that. So
the point, I think, was the way we were going to change it made it a loop, and it excluded all those that had been, we used the word maliciously, I believe, in there. It made a loop out of it and did something strange.
Well, I don't want to hang us up, Ms. Chair. If there's some information that we can pull together at some later point, that's fine. I think I've said all I can say on the subject.
We do know that, of course, that punitive damages couldn't be recovered for, you know, mere negligence, and it would have to go to, conduct would have to go to the extent of indicating a high degree of social irresponsibility. I'm reading from a case counsel showing me here, Schmidt versus Pine Tree Land Development, 291 Oregon 462. To justify punitive damages, the conduct must go beyond mere carelessness to a willful or reckless disregard of risk of harm to others of a magnitude evincing a high degree of social irresponsibility. I think that's the way that I intended malice to be used here.
If that's still the case law, then maybe I'm a little more comfortable.
Yeah, I didn't. I certainly never intended to change the legal meaning of the word malice when I used it here. Any other questions on this? Was that satisfactory? Any disagreement then with adopting Section 2 the way that both versions had it, or Senator Cohen, do you feel
it's fine, as long as we have in the record what
our intent is? Mm-hmm. I think that's clear.
That's
the
valid case law.
So we would be referenced. If someone's looking at the record, basically, our record of the definition of what malice means would be that derived from this case that you referenced?
Yes, what the Oregon Supreme Court has already defined malice to be in a punitive damage case. Okay? All right, then we'll consider Section 2 and 3.
Okay. This is the definition. You want to reference, because the definition of malice is in this other case, because it requires intent, which I think is different than what's there.
As I understand it, there's a case, counsel, why don't you reference that case, and if you could just share with us, I think, your interpretation. It seems to me that, and I will go ahead and read it in the record, this is McElwain versus Georgia Pacific, it's 245 Oregon, 249 is the page reference, and I believe, just quoting briefly, malice as a basis for punitive damages signifies nothing more than a wrongful act done intentionally without just cause or excuse. And if that's the definition that would apply here, I'm comfortable with that, because I think a reckless act would be outside the protection that this affords, which I think is a situation that concerned Representative Dix and myself.
As long as that's on the record, and if anybody goes back to look on what intended, I'm comfortable.
Well, you know, there are a lot of, as I said earlier today, we have an awful lot of Oregon case law on punitive damages, and
it's going to be a bunch of
it's not. It wasn't. I don't think it's the committee's intention to try and change the definition of legal malice that's been set forth in the cases, whatever, and we've had two examples here now. There are others that we can cite in the record. Okay, let's now on page 5. There's another example with one slight difference in the House version. The word Oregon is inserted on lines 25 and 34. and I think that, that is an improvement, but I sense that perhaps there was a feeling that the language upon reflection went a little bit further in the area of than we in the Senate intended it to go, and I get the impression from some comments further than maybe you realize it was going to go on the House side. Let's hear some discussion on this.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. I understand that you know, sort of withdrawn their surfacing of the that of a sort of additional area, and I admit that when we dealt with it once before that we were being presented with the record as if it was going to deal with the vaccines, and but I think we probably didn't take a careful look at what finally got passed. So I just would offer an amendment that that people have around. I don't know whether I want to put it on the table. It has it does get us back to dealing with drugs rather than the whole wide range of products, and I'd want us to consider that as an option when we get to finally deciding what we're going to do here at punitive damages.
Okay. Without making
and we can pass that around.
Okay. Do we have enough copies for
yes. We do. We want those out now.
Well, we might as well have them, and then we can...
Yeah, I think we need copies of it to have it.
You have
it. This is the LC version of what you can...
Okay.
Let me take a look at it and make sure that two extra. I believe this is the LC version.
This is the same thing?
Yeah.
Jason Bowman.
What?
The LC one doesn't have this Jason Bowman.
Oh, okay. Fine. You might want to hand out both of them because it doesn't have the bottom
okay.
circle.
Yeah. Pass this one down too. You're going to get two versions of this. One is LC-65, and the other one is the one that Senator Cohen had. The LC version does not have the language down at the bottom of the non-LC version, which is circled. The purpose of adding the non-LC language is to bring in over-the-counter drugs, proprietary drugs as opposed to prescription drugs. And as I understand it, that's the only purpose for that.
Is that is this one here Senator Gardner's proposal at one point in time?
Yes.
My understanding is that Senator Gardner proposed this at the same time that he proposed the more general language, and that the person who presented it to us decided that the more general language would be more appropriate, so that's what we saw on the Senate side, but that he drafted both.
Go ahead, David.
Knowing that each conferee is here to represent the chamber from which they came, since Senator Cohen has deviated from the version that passed the Senate, I've already expressed I'm a little concerned given the bill that failed last week in the House. It did bring to our attention, and I've mentioned this to other members, that it was the bill relating to chemicals and extermination of termites that... Once that bill, or in the process of that bill failing on the floor, it was brought to members' attention that during the course of discussion on the floor, it was suggested that the EPA had signed off on those chemicals. And checking with the EPA and my local congressman's office, I find out that there are 35 different chemicals that EPA wants to take off the market that they are convinced cause birth defects, but because of a federal law that forces them to purchase the warehouse supply of that particular chemical, In that case, for the termite chemical, it's $110 million worth of chemical in a warehouse. They continue to let those 35 chemicals be used on the market. Now, there is a Republican congressman from Tennessee who's trying to change the law right now, but that's an example where I would think someone could suggest that the federal government had signed off that that chemical's in use, and that chemical, is, it's been suggested, causes birth defects. So I'm a little concerned about it's such broad language in this particular section that it covers everything, and I'm not convinced that looking to Washington, D.C., and relying on them is the best answer. In the case of the flannel pajamas, there again, my understanding is the federal government in that industry turns to the industry for the standards. And those are basically industry writes the standards, they're given to the federal government, and then they're applied. So it's not a case of testing or anything else.
Well, so you're already speaking to the limitation that's contained in this proposed amendment here, which just goes to drugs, then. Is that it?
Yeah, and I mean, I could probably support that, but I think even then there, you could provide instances where drugs have gotten through FDA. I do, my understanding is they're the only agency of the federal government that do the extensive testing, so I could probably support the amendment, but I just, I, when I, when